Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects. It's an absolute joy to have you sitting in with us today. And I am looking at where I am in the world. We're looking at the end of fall. We only have about a month left. And then we're into a pretty solid winter. So it's bracing. I will give you that. And it's a wake up. I know. Let me share a few thoughts about waking up here. Huh? We are absolutely at the living in an amazing period as a Freemason. Absolutely amazing. We have access to. We've come out of the emergence of a disease that's gripped the world, and it caused us to stop. And it interfered with the routine. You know, the routine where you're just going through the motions. You don't really have to expend a lot of energy. Well, that's not us being silly. That's our brain being efficient, because our mind loves efficiency. Anything that we can be done quicker without expending it, without absorbing a lot more energy and oxygen, of course, is preferred. We're creatures that just love routine. So if you've ever been driving along and all of a sudden I don't remember the last five miles or 10 kilometers. It's just so familiar. It's a matter of the fact we step back. In order to keep each other safe, we had to, and because you know, at the start there wasn't a lot known about this disease, particular disease, this COVID disease. There was a little bit of finger pointing, which you tend to expect with weak-minded people, but trying to blame somebody for, you can imagine, trying to blame somebody for something that's been a part of our existence forever, viruses. How do you do that? And all of the frivolous notions of causality. It's very sophomoric. Big on opinion, short on fact. So you think back, before we castigate all these people, you think back, we were like that when we were 13 or 14 years old. We had opinions on everything. if you'd asked us how to solve the problems of the world, we knew, maybe at 16, we absolutely knew. The facts to back that up, not so much. So this pause gave us an opportunity to lift our head up from our labors, and in true Masonic fashion, we began cleaning house, cleaning shop, if you will, cleaning the lab, sorting out the laboratory. It's Hogmanay. we began to realize that we had the perspective now that we could upgrade. Oh, we weren't tossing anything into the bin. We were doing an upgrade in our thinking. What could we do? Is there something we could do that would bring us improve our skill sets? And do that effectively. I don't know if I haven't thought through whether it was efficient. I don't know that. But I think we were looking for effect. And that's, you think about it, in the big scheme of things, that's pretty remarkable in itself. Where I am in the pointy part of Upper Canada, we had been toying with the idea of education rather than a rules-based operation where we do things according to a narrow, it wasn't a strict, but it was a narrow interpretation of Constitution, and it wasn't that on earth at all. It was about the same time, coincidentally, I guess, if there is such a thing anymore, we were affected by the fates. Things happen, you know, bad things happen to good people. And it's a quirk of life that they usually happen in clusters. So we had a cluster. We had a lot of people, you know, that overcooked period after the wars. Well, there were different priorities. Don't get me wrong. I'm moving away from being judgy about whether they were good or bad or better or worse. None of that. That's far too limiting for our order. A lot of our boys were reaching the age where they had to step back, not willingly necessarily, but they had to step back because of their health. It happens. It happens. And it's going to happen to you and me. Yeah, it's the inevitable. And for some, for the fortunate, they had a keyboard with them. So the isolation was reconfigured. I can now, as long as I get a connection with the internet, I'm connected with the bloody world. And a lot of our brethren launched themselves into social media, but we did it with a bit of a curve, didn't we? Is there a way of enhancing, of re-educating ourselves, of taking advantage of a new way of thinking? Not so silly. We're not sitting on the edge of our chairs leaping up at every nuance. Although I see it, and I've seen it as recently as yesterday in a note where somebody was able to parse out problems from a meeting that was the meeting. It was an absolute joy. It was positive, and there was a tremendous amount of energy in the room. And yet, when you, in the minutes, it's easy to pull out, pull it apart and find malfeasance. Yeah, it's in the mind of the beholder, isn't it? If I assigned you that job, find the beauty and find the grace in these notes, in these minutes, I would hope you would do that. But equally, because of our human capacity, if you were assigned to find problems, find flaws, we do that. We are quite capable of doing that. And so we put in some checks and balances to make sure that doesn't get out of hand. The adage is quite true that any power that is not held accountable will become overbearing. It's a bit quirky, isn't it? It's sort of removing the personalities. It's not that guy that becomes a bully. It's that process of how humans, you and I and all the rest of us, deal with power. It can become quite a lustful sensation. So the way that some of the old cultures have taught us, awareness teaches us the need for accountability and constraints to maintain that balance. So it's not just a matter of blind trust. Blind trust is in itself a dishonest term, but you know where I'm going with this. We had that moment in Masonry, and it wasn't as if we were looking into a vacuum. This was an opportunity for a discovery. There had been that thread, and I've talked to you about that. Talked about this on the show before, from the 16th century, when Masonry really was being grounded in Scotland, to this day. I'm a believer that we didn't convey the landmarks, the charges, and the knowledge, the principles and values of Freemasonry en masse, that it was and continues to be a small cadre, a small group of writers and thinkers that have struggled, that took on the task, that had the ability to notice, to observe the world according to a set of principles that had been outlined to us over the years in different manuscripts. And we realized this pause, we realized that we really haven't taken the time, invested the time to understand those manuscripts for ourselves. But in the same instance, we realized there's so much incredible research, high caliber research had been going on out of sight, and it still is. The academics we had a great many people, both formally and informally trained, to be able to examine propositions and ideas objectively. And when you can do that, we know. Of course, we don't get caught up in the distractions of emotion. We stop thinking rationally and emotionally, and we begin to reason things through and think rationally. And it allows us, and as you've seen in the Masonic literature forever and a day, as particularly because we train ourselves in rhetoric, we're examining propositions from all sides, not just the one that we prefer, that we like. And we begin to, we train ourselves to be able to see our argument or our position through the eyes of somebody that disagrees. And we find that by doing that, we are able to, it brings about a clarity of thinking, clarity of judgment, and perhaps in some ways a more accurate version. And we've been doing this for a great long time, but you can imagine, you know, if we think about the entrance to Masonry we're not talking about Thomas More's utopia here. We are diverse, and we don't wear the same uniform the same way, and we don't think the same thoughts the same way. That's the beauty, and I think the strength, one of the strengths of Freemasonry, is this diversification. And we know that, we see proof of that in the way it's been able to move laterally, I would say, around the globe, different faiths in different cultures, and whether at arm's length, we know we adapt to that. But in the fracas, it's a joy, it's pleasant to see how other people observe the craft in all its undertakings. That's curious, because when we put piece together those images, we begin to see a different sense of masonry around the world, more, and I would say more complete than my own. It helps take me out of my own head, so that I'm thinking about masonry in terms of like we would your opinion about style or music or value or right and wrong. You know, all those judgment calls, it varies, and it varies according to the circumstance. Pandemic did that for us. So we discovered we can link with some of the fine minds, if you're inclined to that. If you're inclined to that, we have access to some remarkable material, and we can trace it back. Thank you very much to Petrie Stones and the Gutenberg Project, and you have your own search engines. There's some brilliant Masonic search engines. So we don't need to be struggling to reinvent something that's already being invented for us. But that sense, you know, we still struggle. We're a very proud group, and even though we know that within ritual, in order to achieve, we're offered this golden apple, but to actually taste it. It means that we have to do something about ego, and in a way, you know, it's like Nishi was saying, God is dead, that we've killed it. And in a way, we need to think about killing our own ego in order to discover ourselves and discover more about the world. And we don't even, my goodness, this is outside of a Tao Lodge, it sounds very awkward to talk about this. But academics have been talking about this, and psychologists and psychiatrists for a great long time, there's no shortage of editorials right now dealing with narcissism, and oh my goodness, I can't imagine why, and what a narcissist in power is like. You fill in the blanks as you will, as I know you can. The explosion is these discoveries. There's a risk. We can begin. I don't know if I call it risk any actually, but we can begin to become so self-absorbed. So let's say I want to study alchemy and its connection with Freemasonry. Or the Templars, and I'm thinking, well, the historians say there's just too many centuries in between. So the sense that there was a continuous link between Templars and Freemasonry is a bit suspicious. We might want to examine that. But if you're swept up in the Arthurian romance of Templar, this question has no meaning, no bearing on you. No, my goodness, no. But we have... found, so I can study that to my heart's content. And if I want to study it once and think, well, now I'm a genius because I've read one article, or I can write the final exam because I've studied the footnotes or the cheat sheets or the. But if you become an old fellow like Miraz, you become an old fellow like me, you find that we can follow the threads completely, but. Son of a gun, in masonry, the threads often overlap. Now, you didn't tell me that when you made me erase me. You didn't tell me that there was going to be so much connectivity within Masonry, of major philosophical schools, of practical work, of bearing an influence, and the way that Masonry understands the human condition. I think it's for me, that I find that fascinating. But the threads, you begin to realize that you can come at an understanding after you realize it. Nobody's telling me what the hell this is. It's like, what do I do now? Well, now it's like, apply yourself or don't, because there's nobody going to scold you. Nobody's going to make you value your life enough to want to remold yourself in closer to the ideal of Freemasonry. Nobody does that to us. That's something that comes from within. It's like my friend that years ago bought a cello, and now it's like remarkable. I always thought remarkable instrument, but to listen to him play in symphony is take the hours and the dedication and the joy. He absolutely loves it. Is it Shostakovich? Maybe that was a good strong influence, or maybe Yo-Yo Ma. I hope, but I enjoy it. To your heart's content. To your heart's content. Still, we can look at the boys around us that seem puzzled and confused by all this. And I feel for them, especially the boys that feel that they're incapable. And I think that's something that falls on the rest of us, because remember, there was a time, and it's a metaphor here, of course. There was a time when operative Masons were in the field and came together and formed what we refer to as the roots of speculative Freemasonry, and we trace the history of this. So we have some facts about all this, and we notice of course, when gentrified people came in, speculative Masonry began to take root. There were men, through no fault of their own, that were carrying out the trade, highly skilled men, but with illiterate. They were unable to read and write. So rather than class divisions occurring, there were speculative Masons that had the opportunity to be educated, that were literate and had access to libraries, and were reading and sharing ideas with those that couldn't or didn't. The exchange. So you and I might take issue with that these days. Who's anybody to tell me what to do? You know, that silliness. But think back to a time when education was critical and valued, where men and women would working to develop small communities would ensure that a schoolhouse was built very early on. Maybe it was right after the jail, but what is more important, the courthouse or the school? The school represents the future of your community, doesn't it? And they took form. Now, that was a different time, and we still see that when people come from other places to this country. They want their children to have as much education, because they see that as access to a better life. And yet it's not everybody. It's not everybody. Not everybody has that same opportunity, even the opportunity to make a connection between delayed reward, education, and benefit further down the line. You know, you work hard and you sacrifice for little wage to do in you're taught and trained so that you can become productive and make a contribution later on. That delay. And other people want and need an immediate response. They can't, for whatever their circumstance does not allow for delay. And to be honest with you, if you have a hungry mouth to feed, it's a pretty easy decision about what direction you're going to go in. We can't be swept up with a petty suggestion that our educational system represents the talent in the nation, because it fails to do that. Although some leaders over the centuries have promoted access to education for people that otherwise wouldn't have it because of circumstance, their life circumstance. We have that capacity to study or not. You remember your college days and see some people that got there that had been so restrained by, you know, suffocated by the control of parents, and they just went wild, they let loose. And some of them reined it in enough to continue, and others just self-destructed. Because you all of a sudden you're making decisions for yourself without being oppressed or without being judged. You had to make decisions for yourself. We have that, all of that inherited background comes with us into Masonry. The law student that hates the practice, or the physician that hates the practice but is doing it because of family pressure. Have you had those conversations? I'm sure you've had those conversations. So we also have this thing that what do we need to do in practical and instrumental kinds of terms, and then heart's desire. Masonry fits, I think, beautifully into heart's desire. Do you want to find satisfaction with your circumstance and what you have? You look around you. Are you tired? You just want to get out of the rat race and go and find a mountain stream and sit down and breathe in the air. Do some reading, not be too troubled by a phone ringing or somebody making a demand of you. Heart's desire. Masonry offers that, huh? Or the fellow that's on the shop floor thinking, gee, you know, you meet the fellow that are doing a common task, and yet they're brilliant. You know, they're reading Homer and Virgil and think, there's a mind at work. we see that all the time. There comes a sense of spirituality about existence and awareness of our place in the universe. That is not only fed by Freemasonry, and yet we are a small speck on the map. Collectively, what are we? 3 million? We're very, very small, and our numbers have been shrinking for demographics has been at play. But lo and behold, we find this need to not close up the shop, but clean it up. Let's get this reorganized. Let's look around and see what we can do to energize ourselves and to look as far into the future and ask ourselves what kind of skill sets our brethren are going to need in order to be productive in the future. And all of these, you find the search engine that works for you, but the risk is that we just become, we develop tunnel vision, isn't it? I could just study the right elbow of Hiram Abiff for the rest of my days and be completely happy, except for these darn threads that keep crossing over. You know, there you have to be a bit of a magpie, I think. You know, it's just once you think you've found something that is just captivating, lo and behold, along comes something else that grabs your imagination. Anyway, we have a good show today. Narrative meets logic, and the music, poof, And the poet, we haven't had anything by W.B. Yeats for a while. Yeah, I know there's a lot of fans of W.B. Yeats, so we're going to try a little taste of his Lake of Innisfree. Here, Ben Webster. Thank you. I guess that'll do. Ben Webster. Just incredible. Here's something I could use your help with. Conversation started with you, wherever you are. And a shout out to people in New Zealand and you folks over in Brazil. You're facing summer coming, and enjoy. I'm facing snow here. Narrative meets logic, the complementarity of masonry. It is not as if one form is better than the other. They each have a place in our history and in our future. We have always relied on studious brethren to pass along their findings to those who have little, if any, inclination. Freemasonry is a steganographer's dream, in part because we use symbols to convey elaborate pieces of knowledge. Of course, we respect our researchers. Masonology was once a narrow lane of research, but by limiting our reading to works by Masons, we ignored the energy and findings of the historians, antiquarians, and philosophers at large. Who could have imagined the impact the internet would have on our order? Fingertip access was a dream come true for those of us with a job that used the accelerated flow of information. From the outside, it would all seem quite confusing. Thanks to market pressures, user-friendly sophistication has moved in. At the heart of both narrative and rational Freemasonry is the exchange of ideas. I cannot apologize for so much overlap. There is an overarching complementarity in play. As we learn more about diversification, I mean more personal, up close, it takes us one step closer to our own unifying theory of the Masonic universe. Well, don't be too harsh with me. We have a calendar that we use. Why not an overarching theory? What enlightens me might have little appeal to you and vice versa. By listening to those divergent approaches, we fill in the gaps. By listening to your approach, it helps me to understand my own thinking. Every one of us has questions, whether they are the same questions Masons have been asking for hundreds of years is irrelevant. It is our question in our timeline. Huzzah! 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 I don't understand that. Bill Evans. Hmm. Yeah, that's from his material in 1964 to, yeah, lovely stuff. Lovely stuff. A little bit of honesty creeps into the show here. Observation, William Butler Yeats. This is a poet. There's something about poetry that just draws us in. It's like lying under a moonlit night and all of a sudden observing things. Or that in a rush you would not otherwise see. And the poets pull together these an understanding, an analysis, and references. And here, William Butler Yeats does that for us. We try here on the show to select poets with some, you know, some curb appeal that may, like most of us, you know, may not have been studying this for a great long time. So that we can have a bit of a taste, always a sampler, or at least weekly, a sample of these different minds. And as they lean in, what observations they're prepared to share with us. And as you've heard me say different times, I find this enormously courageous to be able to put yourself out there. And knowing that the crowd, the marketplace may not be in a mood for poetry, although, you know, most days people where I am are tuning in their radios and listening to songs that are, and the lyrics, what more are they? They're poems. Yeats was born in 1865, so he's from the period, Victorian period, where we're just happy with the guy. We're just happy to be absorbed. Irish, so, you know, and think back, ancients and moderns, and that quarrel, English and Irish, you know, went head to head, and I'm grateful for what the Irish warrants, Irish Lodge warrants, and what they did to accelerate things. He's a dramatist, he wrote prose, and what he considered one of the greatest, we get this a lot, one of the greatest English language poets of the 20th century. After the First World War, 1923, he received a Nobel Prize for Literature. He's the kid of a barrister, and his dad. Interesting, his dad went on to become a painter, portrait painter. And his mom, this is, I think, Sligo. She's from Sligo, and that's what the western part of Ireland. Yeah. She was the daughter of a prosperous merchant, yes, in Western Ireland. And they claimed, the parents claimed kinship with Anglo-Irish Protestant families who are mentioned in this work. Now, normally, Yeats would have been expected to identify with his Protestant tradition, which represented a powerful minority among Ireland's predominantly Roman Catholic population, but he didn't. He was separated from both historical traditions available to him in Ireland from the Roman Catholics because he did not share the faith, and from the Protestants because he felt repelled by their concern for material success. So Yeats' best hope, he felt, was to cultivate a tradition more profound than either the Catholic or the Protestant, a tradition of a hidden Ireland that existed largely in the anthropological evidence of its surviving customs and beliefs and holy places, more pagan than Christian. Now, I kind of like that. When I hear that, I kind of like that. I kind of like these. He's scratching off the outer coat of paint, and he's finding something underneath. Huh? Yeah. So this is a guy, yes, he was... he attended Metropolitan School of Art in Dublin, but he was also raised in London, and he joined the Theosophical Society because of the appeal of mysticism. And I think you can still have access to that if you're so inclined. But the age of science was repellent to Yeats. He was a visionary, and he insisted upon surrounding himself with poetic images. Man, I wonder if you and I can do that. If we see the ugliness too much, can we just surround ourselves? So he began to study the work of William Blake, who, interesting man all of himself, and this brought him into contact with different traditions, the Platonic, Neoplatonic, the Swedenborgian, and the alchemical. This is an interesting Mason. This is an interesting guy to sit down and talk with. I wonder if he's a Freemason. Anyway, he was the co-founder of the Rhymers Club, and that had Lionel Johnson and Arthur Symons and a lot of very notables in it. Anyway, Yeats, the Irish nationalist. The poem I'm going to portray for you today is The Lake Isle of Innisfree. And this is published in his second book of poems in 1893. It's one of his first, they're considered one of his first great poems. And one of the penultimate lines jolts the speaker and the reader back from the reality of the drab or, urban existence. It says, "While I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray," final line, "I hear in it the deep heart's core." It's a crucial statement, Innisfree, the Isle of Heather, is located on the south shore of Lough Gill in County Sligo. Why does Yeats want to take off there? It's a feeling that one can probably all relate to, wanting to leave the world and the life we inhabit and get back to nature and to a simpler existence. It seems more spiritual fulfilling, eh? More tranquil and wholesome. And this is what this poem is about. See if you can relate, if he's connected with you. "I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and I will live alone in the bee loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales in the morning to where the cricket sings. There's midnights all a glimmer and a noon of purple glow. So evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shores. And while I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core."
"Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss, the bell, a dream on you. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on. When I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be with you, weaving romances, making believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Give me what you alone can give, a kiss the velvet moon." Thank you. When I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be with you. Even romances make you believe the truth. Oh, give me lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Oh, give me what you want to give. I'll give the pills a dream on.
Yeah, strong. Notice that we don't play jazz that has singers, with the exception of Louis Armstrong. Just a very, very interesting man with tremendous courage. Lovely, a lovely artist. I don't know if we find that masonry evolved as a result of hard-nosed business approach, sort of a marshaling of authority, or artistry and the grace that could put, it could discuss the influences of church and state without losing the rag. To have a sensible discussion, always a sensible discussion of things that in other environments could be quite volatile. It's like there was an invisible protection afforded by the sanctity, the spirituality of Lodge. You know, when we deal with the greater lights, that extended a bubble of grace to us so that we could be conversant, we could be opinionated, and we could learn things, the lessons from Greece and even before, from Athens. Today, our work, Margaret Jake C. Jacobs is helping us understand the influences of English Freemasonry on the Netherlands and a distribution of information that had been for quite some time, 15th, 16th, 17th century. It was a merchant center, and they did quite well, good traders, and men formed powerful alliances. And so we're talking here, we're hearing references to people that we ought never have heard about. This one today is about William Bendick. And we're looking through, we've looked into the 1735 rioters in The Hague. And they were, it brought up the charge of homosexuality against the Masons. You remember, we're not immune from harsh judgment. Why are all these men getting together? Well, it must be homosexuality. Well, today in our current values, you think, well, then it was considered a crime. Poof. He was, of course, a key figure in the revolution of 1748, William Bendick. And he was, as a Dutch Whig, feet on the ground, belt and suspenders, probably the best description of the political goals. Bentinck wanted to see British institutions exported to the Republic, and not least he wanted to forge alliances among progressive troops, sympathetic to the Anglo-Dutch alliance, and the Stadtholderate, the establishment. Eh? He wrote to his mum that he was appalled by our miserable constitutions without any executive power. This is no ordinary kind of guy. He was curator of the University of Leiden, and he took an interest in appointing liberal theologians within the faculty, and he was a promoter of scientific inquiry. Sounds like a really decent Mason, eh? In his way, Bentinck was a Republican who wanted to see a strong central government develop in the Republic as the guarantor of Anglo-Dutch alliance and in opposition to the corruption, as he imagined it, of the regents. Again, power without accountability. And so Bentinck, along with his brother Charles, belonged to a small circle of mid-century reformers in the Republic. They read the writings of the French philosophers and even welcomed Rousseau and Diderot to their homes. A little sidebar, worth a quick look. There's lots of material on YouTube and on through Google. Worth a look. If you're inclined, take a look at our ritual and our constitution, and then see if you can find the application of Diderot's thinking and Rousseau's thinking that influenced that. The Netherlands convinced that greater social equality existed there than in France. Progressive aristocrats associated with the Masonic lodges, the Bentincks had social contact with groups normally excluded from the most elite circles of the Republic: merchants, minor government officials, publishers, Amsterdam Jews, the type of men who turn up in the membership records. Why not also women? Uh-huh. This was the challenge of this open-mindedness. Why not women? How much of the ethos of Freemasonry is defined by gender? Well, we should have that. Let's have that conversation. I would like a single malt, please, with just a few drops of water, and maybe a Guinness to knock that back. There's one other factor that plays into the question in ways that may never fully be understood. Bentinck's marriage was notoriously troubled, and his wife understood their plight in terms of larger than simply personal. It led her to speculate on the inequalities between men and women, on the inferiority of her circumstances as a woman. My goodness, it's the conversation is still happening today. Bentinck could not have been unfamiliar with her analysis, and it was well known to her confidants in the Netherlands and abroad. The equality espoused by La Loge du Geste defied the reality of women's circumstances in every European society. Might it not have also assuaged a conscience troubled by charges for which there was no obvious rebuttal? My goodness. I see that we're at the end of a show. I'm sitting here looking at, reading through the Shaw manuscript. That we'll leave that for another day. And I'm reminded tomorrow is the, in 1687, Nell Gwynn died. She was an orange. She started off as selling oranges in the street, threadbare. And and became enormously influential with kings. Thank you for tuning in today, wherever you are in the face of the earth. Thank you, Europe, for your support, and the Balkans, thank you, and Turkey. I'm very, very pleased that we have listeners that have remained curious. Ireland, thank you very much, and Britain, yes, and of course North America, in indebted, and from the and to think that we have the listeners tuning in from New Zealand. Thank you. I'm enormously grateful. It's affirmation. You can tell that this type of program is a complete indulgence, isn't it, in many ways. But I'd like to think that it also offers, without being overbearing or obsequious, a thoughtful conversation with you. And only that we could sit down together and have a drink or two and enjoy our time and share our thoughts as Masons. So in the event that might happen, I hope you'll tune in next week. And in the meantime, the world is unstable right now. And one of the things that is playing well is the sense of stability, the history. You and I, symbolically and figuratively, offer that to the world, feet on the ground. And to be able to be honest enough to say that we don't have answers for all of the problems is perhaps one of our saving graces. Some of these things are enormously complicated. And I would never dare to be so simplistic to say, just to adopt all of these values and the world will be a better place. It's a little more complicated than that. But we have a duty and an obligation to our fellows. So whatever your stream of masonry, whatever brass ring you happen to be searching for, whatever tincture you're blending in your laboratories, by all means, I wish and hope much success in your endeavors. And but the fact that you're doing that and doing it anonymously, is a great sense of affirmation for the process of masonry. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, and by all means, include yourself in there once in a while. I'll see you again real soon. And I hope you survive. Last week I was off gallivanting around a symposium on Scottish Freemasonry in America. So it was well worth it, and I hope in future shows I'll be able to show that it picked up a few really interesting ideas. Thanks for now. Bye. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.